And that is what Jacob is preparing to do. And anybody want to talk about, tell me what some things we learned about worship in the last three Wednesdays? What are some of the things that we learned about worship?
Everything we do is not worship.
True. Genesis 22 is a good example of that. Abraham going to the land of Moriah and to the mount which God would show him to offer Isaac his sacrifice. And when they arrived, he told the young men, "Tarry here and I and the lad will go yonder and worship." That's very important verses to remember as well. What else did we learn?
Serving and worship are two different things.
Absolutely. We learned that especially from John 13, didn't we? Where the Lord was giving service and a lesson to the disciples. Was he worshiping them? Obviously not. There in John 13. Okay.
Place of worship has changed. It's not the same.
True. John chapter 4, where Jesus is talking to the woman in Samaria there at Jacob's well. And she said that the Jews say that Jerusalem is the place where we ought to worship. If you notice Deuteronomy chapter 12, the entire chapter, God does designate that under the law of Moses that it would be the place where he would choose to place his name. And then we find that coming into effect in 1 Kings 9 verse 3 in the temple, which was in Jerusalem. And then coupled with that is exactly what the Lord is talking about there in John chapter 4, that there will be a time when you'll not worship in this mountain neither in Jerusalem. Because both the patriarchal law would go away, it was going to go away, and so was the law of Moses. And so where would the worship be under the dispensation which we live now, the law of Christ?
We can worship anywhere we want to as long as we meet and worship in the name of Jesus Christ our Lord.
Yeah, the place of worship. Where has God set His name now? Before it was Jerusalem, and before that it was with the faithful such as Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. Where has He placed His name now?
Christians.
In Christians, yeah. Absolutely. We have taken His name. We are. That's the reason why we are the temple of God now, the New Testament teaches us. So where is the worship now? It is within the church. Wherever the church is gathered, that's where we worship. And so that same principle, as we find in Deuteronomy 12, and I mentioned that as a whole chapter, because really the whole chapter talks about that. And we learned there that wherever God has set His name is where we're to worship. Okay? Anything else that we learned? Anybody remember?
God is very specific in the acts that need to be done during.
Yeah, we learned that from Jeroboam, didn't we? Jeroboam, son of Nebat, who changed the person of worship, the period of worship, the place of the worship, and the priesthood of the worship. And all of those things are found today in church. As far as the person is concerned, that's God. And the period of the worship is, in particular, we're talking about the worship on the Lord's Day, and that's specified. It's the first day of the week, every first day of the week. Acts 20 and verse 7, 1 Corinthians 16, 1 and 2, so forth. And also, the priesthood of the worship is us, inasmuch as we are priests of God. And so we understand that we're to do the worshiping. The worshiping happens in the church. And so we know that all those things are specified of God as to what we're to do. It was under the law of Moses, under the patriarchal period for that matter. We learned that even here. And also under the law of Christ. Okay? Just a little quick review over that and to kind of keep that in our mind. So that's all very good to learn. Okay? Now, let's just notice now verses 1 through 4. That's what we want to notice here as we pick up again. And God said unto Jacob, "Arise, go up to Bethel, and dwell there, and make there an altar unto God that appeared unto thee when thou fleddest from the face of Esau thy brother. Where is that? Do you remember, anybody remember the chapters of Genesis where that's found? Where did that happen?
What was the question?
Where was it that, in what chapters of Genesis does it, we see the account of Jacob fleeing, why he fled and where he fled and what happened as he started? Anybody remember? Fled from Esau. You remember
31?
That? No, that would be from Laban. That's another fleeing, as it were, under the direction of God, of course. He told him to leave Padan Aram over in 28, yeah. The end of chapter 27 and then chapter 28. And we find particularly Bethel coming into the picture in Genesis 28. You remember that Jacob saw the vision of the ladder. Okay, I'm just bringing those things up to help us remember where they are, some key things. You know, if you can kindly remember a key point from various chapters, that'll really help you think, okay, I need to find this. This is connected with this thought, and then you flip to that chapter, and you know, you become a walking concordance, as it were. So, number 2 here, verse 2, "Then Jacob said unto his household and to all that were with him, put away the strange gods that are among you, and be clean, and change your garments." And we notice that as well, that there are various times in the Old Testament and then even seen in the New Testament where these things are done. Putting away the things that are in error, false gods, false doctrines, and cleaning, becoming clean before God. Now, number 3, or verse 3, I keep saying numbers, verse 3, "And let us arise and go up to Bethel, and I will make there an altar unto God who answered me in the day of my distress and was with me in the way which I went." Now, just exactly what event that Jacob has reference to is not mentioned. It very well may be that he's talking about everything from Genesis 27, verse 41 and following all the way down to this particular time, to this very verse. Because Jacob has dealt with God's providence and God's promises in various ways and has many things of many different occurrences or situations of distress. In Genesis 27 and 28, he comes away from Canaan and goes into Haran because of Esau. And in chapter 29 and 30, he, of course, he marries and ends up being deceived by Laban, and then his children come along, and he works his plan that God gives him about his increase from Laban's flocks. And then in chapter 31, he flees from Laban, comes back into Canaan. Of course, in chapters 32 and 33, has altogether to do with meeting Esau. There's great distress on his part there. And also in chapter 33, his name is changed. He wrestles with the man of God. In chapter 34, his sons murder all the males in the city of Shechem. And now we're in chapter 35. So there's been an awful lot happened to Jacob since chapter 27. And that's all the way in which he's went. You remember that he had made in his vow that he made to God in chapter 28, where he anointed the stone with oil and he promised to give a tenth. "If you will be with me and bless me in all the way that I go, I'll be faithful, I will give a tenth." And God had already promised that he would. So he's reiterating, "Yes, you've promised this, and now I'm giving this promise in relation to the promise that you had already made." And so, absolutely, Jacob is realizing this, and just time after time throughout all of these chapters, what God has been doing for him to bring about God's own purpose. And now verse 4, "And they," the people that were with him, "and they gave unto Jacob all the strange gods which were in their hand, and all their earrings which were in their ears, and Jacob hid them under the oak which was by Shechem."
What's the correlation with the earrings, though?
Yeah, good question. Earrings were a very common ornament in many lands. We see earrings being depicted in many of the hieroglyphic renderings in Egypt, and their statues even, and in many other cultures. And you remember, there's going to be quite a correlation, and there has been even, between Abraham and Isaac, both going into Egypt. And many other lands, of course, were being influenced by Egypt. In this day, Egypt was a very important nation even then. And so that was a very common thing. And also in many cultures, the earring or earrings, both worn by women and men, that they would have some reference, even inscribed on them, having to do with idolatry. They would sometimes have maybe some type of phrase on there, sort of like we would see somebody having a phrase that they want to repeat in order to protect themselves from a god, from evil spirits, and that sort of thing, as a talisman used in various type of superstitious and idolatrous fashion. And that's obviously the context here.
When we were in Africa, there were parts there that recognized like anklets to mean prostitution, or like it was a form of slavery at one point.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And also toe rings, you know, as to be caught up in the juju and other things too.
Okay, and that's some type of religion, right?
Yeah. You know?
So that it had some type of significance, meaning something. Yeah, so that's the basic idea here. Not necessarily every culture it would be that way, that they would have an earring would mean that, but it is obviously used in that sense here, that it had to do with idolatry, and it would be some type of a token of idolatry or some type of a, something that they would hold dear to themselves, that they could maybe read the inscription on it and repeat that to protect them from evil or something of that nature. Just as an extra side note, think about the correlation between what I've just said and Hail Mary beads, Catholic shoes, mantras. Every bead represents a Hail Mary or Our Father or some other type of prayer. Same thing, brethren. It's the same thing. Yeah, they're parallel, both in reasoning and even in physically speaking. Something, some physical thing to remind you of these various mantras. You pray so many Hail Marys and so many Our Fathers to absolve yourself, to be absolved from sin. That type of thing. Ridiculous. Now, that's one of the reasons why the Catholic Church had such a great popularity in so many places, because they absorbed the idolatrous practices around them and converted it.
John, does that bead have something on it that they know that it means that? Or?
Juan, you're our resident Catholic expert.
The rosary is separated by, you have five beads of one kind, and then there's one, you know, the spacing is different too, so you know, it's in groups of five, so you know, each bead has a certain significance. Like, you might have, I don't remember if it's the Hail Mary or there's also the Our Father. So you have so many of one and then one of another until you work your way around to the crucifix itself.
The reason I ask, I've seen them and they don't kind of do their fingers like their feet.
Right, yeah. So you don't even have to look at it because you can feel.
You're counting them off, aren't you?
Count them.
Is there any inscription on the bead itself?
No.
Yeah. And they have little separating beads or something?
Right.
Do those have an inscription on them that you've ever seen?
No, they're just spaced.
Okay. I've never had a hold of one or seen one. But, I mean, except on like on television or something. I mean, I realize how they're put together, but I've never had a hold of one. That's so they're counting them, Betty, is what they're doing. And the Hail Mary and Our Father, how long does it take you to say one of those prayers? 2 seconds or something? I mean, it's short, isn't it?
Yeah, they're very short.
And it's rote. It's a mantra. Just say it and you don't have to think about it. Just, do it. Okay, I've done five. Okay, I've got that done. I go to the next, whatever.
The Lord's Prayer, you know.
So it's short, you know. It only takes you just a bit. But it's meaningless in actuality what the words actually are. If you say those thousands and thousands of times and you're doing it at the behest of your priest, it gets to the point where it doesn't mean anything. That's shallow or hollow praise, prayer.
It's just...
He doesn't, he's not going to hearken under that superficial ridiculousness. It's sin, is what it is, and God doesn't like sin. Okay, so we see that correlation there, and that's what the earring situation is in this passage, certainly. And so Jacob will hide them under the oak, which was by Shechem. What does the New King James say there? Does it have a different word besides oak?
Terebinth.
Terebinth. Okay, I thought so. I did not look up what that is. Juan has Strong's on his iPhone. I don't. It may just say terebinth. At that point, I'm not sure what a terebinth tree is.
We see that a lot in the Old Testament. I mean, that terebinth tree comes up over and over again.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's not used in the King James. I don't recall that word being there at all. That's just the difference in the translation. I think Strong is going to mention terebinth. I know the Brown driver in Briggs does.
Well, Strong uses the King James, so it says oak, but it says an oak or other strong tree.
Or other strong, well, it could be almost anything there. Okay.
In my Bible, it says that it's a long living, deciduous tree, such as an oak.
Okay.
Tree has red berries and the leaves are shaped like feathers. Because the tree lived a long time, ancient people often used the terebinth tree to commemorate important events or to mark places of worship.
Okay. Well, that may or may not be accurate, but anyway, you can see how if it's a deciduous tree, meaning it drops its leaves through the year, say in the fall time or whatever, like they do, like oak trees do here, or some of them do here anyway, I guess, but that's the reason why, if it's not properly an oak as we would think of it, oak would be in England. Oak, the oak tree, the brown oak tree, and so forth, is a long-lived tree, an important tree for them. So you can understand why they might correlate that over to oak. And remember, this comes out of 1611, the English translation, which actually came. It may go all the way back to the 400s with Jerome and the Latin Vulgate, which is actually where our King James came out of in many respects, because of the Bibles that preceded the King James, which were revisions out of the Vulgate.
When they would allude to those that were practicing idolatry, they would talk about going to the high places or every spreading tree.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah, they obviously had some type of a
canopy, or
they had some kind of special little grove, trees, group of trees where they practiced idolatry. Yep. So trees are obviously very important in Old Testament history, certainly is, no doubt about it. They're mentioned in many ways. And this same type of tree mentioned concerning Abraham and pitching his tent there near Shechem. Okay, so they have not yet made it, they haven't come to Bethel yet. We'll wait till we get to verse 6. So they're leaving their gods behind, and everything that has to do with idolatry, including their earrings or anything else.
Could it have also been, too, a part of the plunder that they took from the place of Shechem?
Oh, I would think that might very well be. That might even have been the bulk of it, certainly. It's very reasonable to think
that, again, Jacob realized it was wrong, and he probably, again, looked at those items as being sinful and...
Yeah, understood that. Yeah, if Rachel still had any of the teraphim from her father, we don't know at this point. It's not mentioned again. I would think that would be involved, and certainly they're from Shechem. Whatever may have come out of there with their captives, or maybe what they picked up and brought out, I don't know. Yep, I'd say that's a very reasonable thought there. And remember, there were more people in Jacob's household than just his blood relatives. They had people, their men servants and maid servants, and at this point they also this is obviously just after the time of what happened in Shechem there in chapter 34, so there may not have been any change. They may have or still had all of those captive people, and what happened to them we don't know. But so it's very reasonable that some of this, or maybe even the bulk of it, came out of Shechem. So I think that's very reasonable to suggest that could be. Now, verse 5, and they, Jacob and his entire family, they journeyed, and the terror of God, and this is an important verse concerning what happened at the end of chapter 34, and they journeyed, and the terror of God was upon the cities that were round about them, and they did not pursue after the sons of Jacob. What does that verse mean concerning the terror of God?
Afraid of God.
True, but what also is implied there?
God gave them protection,
yep,
from the people around them.
That's right. Well, God will also do that many years later concerning Israel coming into the land of Canaan to possess it and crossing over. Fear was in the hearts of the people of Canaan oftentimes. And God saw to it that that happened. Now, what about what the last portion of that verse, and they did not pursue after the sons of Jacob? Well, we see the reason why that God struck terror in the hearts of the people in that region, the land of Canaan, so that they would not come in and destroy them. Even though Simeon and Levi both deserve some punishment, that's going to come forth, you'll remember, later concerning Genesis chapter 49. That's about verses 6 and 7, if I recall, concerning Simeon and Levi, and that they would be spread out, scattered among the tribes of Israel. Okay? Now, as far as any personal punishment on Simeon and Levi, it doesn't mention whether anything came forth. Their father did not approve of what they did, certainly. But it just doesn't tell us that there was any other immediate repercussions or what they did about that afterwards. It's just not mentioned here. Now, verse 6, we see a change now coming as to where they're located. So Jacob came to Luz, which is in the land of Canaan. That is Bethel. Anybody remember when we were looking at chapter 28, the correlation between Luz and the actual place of Bethel? Anybody remember what we looked at there? May not. That's been quite a while back now. Right. It seems that Luz was the former name, and it seems to have been perhaps more of the established city area adjacent to the area where Jacob had stayed that night there in chapter 28 where he saw the vision. He was obviously outside of the settlement area there in chapter 28, and he called that place Bethel, but both the whole area, with the name for the whole area is obviously interchangeable between Bethel and Luz. So when we see those words being used, we're basically thinking of the same area. So it'll be used many times, especially when Israel comes into Canaan. This area will be important. Remember Dan and Bethel, where Jeroboam, son of Nebat, put golden calves. We studied that last week. So that they all came to Bethel, he and all the people that were with him. And he built there an altar and called the place El Beth-El, because there God appeared unto him when he fled from the face of his brother. Well, literally, there would be God, house, God, in just in the literal, the way that that's said there. Yes, ma'am. Okay, it is close to Jerusalem, that's true. Yeah, it is. And as I said, the name Luz and Bethel became interchangeable for that whole region there. Obviously both the city area and then the outskirt area as well, which would be like a region around the city. Okay, question? No. You just look like you're about to ask a question. Okay, so just to put it simply, they came back to the place where Jacob saw his vision in chapter 28. That's exactly what God told him to do in verse 1. You go back to the place where I appeared to you, and you build an altar there and worship me. So that's what's happening here. And he called the place El Beth-El, because there God appeared unto him when he fled from the face of his brother. It all has to do with the house of God. Now, next verse is quite interesting in actuality. If you think about it a little bit. And Deborah, Rebekah's nurse, died, and she was buried beneath Bethel under an oak. Does New King James say Terebinth again? Okay. And the name of it was called Al-Lan-Bay-Kuth. Luan, would you look that up in your Strongs to see
literally Terebinth of weeping.
Terebinth of weeping. Why? They cried at the oak where Deborah was buried, obviously. Oak of weeping. Okay. All right. Now, who was Rebecca? Whose wife? Isaac's wife. Right? Okay. She was sister to Laban. Correct? Their father was Bethuel. Right? Okay. Now, whose mother was Rebekah?
Jacob.
And Esau, right? Okay. Now, think of this. This is the lady that was nurse to Jacob's mother. And she's now with them. Where do you think that they acquired Deborah, as it were? She's a servant, obviously, at least in some form, probably of great influence and import to the family, obviously. How did they come to have a relationship, a familial relationship with Deborah?
Is it because of his inheritance being the first? I mean, getting Esau, in other words, a lot of his father's possessions passed on?
Well, what's the word nurse in the Strong's? If it's just, New King James say something different, or is it nurse there as well? It's nurse, okay. I appreciate Juan looking that up for me. Did it just say nurse? Or? Okay, that doesn't matter, but what does it give the meaning? Okay. Okay. Mothering? Okay. So it has the connotation of a nurse as someone who would take care of another as a child. That's interesting. So Deborah, according to the word, according to Strong's anyway, was the woman who took care of Rebekah when she was a baby. How old does that make Deborah? You think?
Probably did the same also for Jacob when he was little.
Well, I would say that Deborah probably wasn't there.
Well, why would you say that?
I think she stayed in Haran. She took care of Rebekah when Rebekah was little, and she was little in Haran. I think she stayed with Laban. Because there's nobody came with Jacob. When did they pick her up? Jacob hasn't come back to his father.
I thought he did come back to his father.
Does it say so? I may have missed
that. Well, I'm just saying, when he came back to and he saw his brother and stuff,
did it say that? I may have missed that.
I'm speculating. I can't be for certain.
Well, let's look and see. Chapter 33. Okay. It doesn't happen at the end of chapter 33. And that's where he and Esau part company, and Esau returns to Seir. And that's where Jacob ends up being near the city of Shechem. And then chapter 34 has all together to do with that.
Would it have something to do with going back to the point where it talks about his father dying? That the boys would have been there?
That'll be the end of this chapter, of chapter 35. They haven't gotten to that point
okay.
yet. Now that's a long time before. Where was she? Was she with?
59:59.
Okay, good. Glad y'all are doing some checking here. 24:59, you say? Okay, let's see where she is. Now, okay. And her nurse, if that's still Deborah.
Well, it would only seem reasonable because of the fact that if the custom wouldn't have changed when even Jacob left, he took his wives and their nurse.
Right. Well, let me ask you this. Is there any reference at all when Jacob left Canaan to go to Haran that he took anybody with him? No, where is that there in chapter 24? Okay. Okay. Well, Exodus 2:7 won't have anything to do with this. That's be too far in the future. There. That would be just a reference to a nurse, not this one. That's hundreds of years in the future.
I just assumed that when he made the return back and met his brother, that he was reunited with his family.
Not mentioned as yet. So I don't know. I don't know where she came in the picture. She's in the picture here anyway. They picked her up somewhere. Now, is the nurse in chapter 24 Deborah? Well, could be. one would think that's pretty reasonable. Did she end up going back to Haran? I don't know. It's an interesting question, isn't it? Where did she come in? She was obviously with Jacob at the end of her life here. I sort of suspect that she was probably in Haran. But whether she was or not, I don't know. And whether she's the nurse there in chapter 24 or not, verse 59, I don't know. It may not be the same Hebrew word either. I don't know. You'd have to look that up. Probably is, though. Good. Very good. Glad you all looked that up. You're using your research ability there. Good on you. So.
It could be that she did leave with Rebecca originally. And then maybe at some point...
Went back?
This time and the time when Jacob went back, maybe she went back to Haran for some...
Anytime from Genesis 24 to now. Well, I don't know.
Maybe she went back for something, and then she came to return with Jacob.
Certainly possible.
Would she have been released after her mistress died?
Oh, after, well, could be. We don't have a record of, about.
Or maybe she would go back to, as Mike's indicating, go back to her own family.
After Rebecca passed away? Don't know when she passed away. Doesn't tell us, as far as Rebecca's concerned. She obviously wasn't taking care of Rebecca here. So, interesting question. Obviously, the lady's pretty well advanced in age, obviously, at this point.
I just went back here. It's under Deborah. It just says Rebecca's nurse, Genesis 35:8.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So, that's an interesting thing to think about. There's a few possibilities there as to how and where. It's important enough that it's in Scripture, isn't it? Okay. And so we understand the word that was called here, the weeping tree, as it were. All right. Now, verse 9. And God appeared unto Jacob again, and he came out of, when he came out of Padan Aram and blessed him. And God said unto him, Thy name is Jacob. In other words, it was formerly Jacob. Thy name shall not be called any more Jacob, but Israel shall be thy name. And he called his name Israel. Well, that had happened earlier in chapter 33, wasn't it? Let's see, let me make sure I'm right.
Why do you suppose that God changes?
For chapter 32, then. I'm sorry? It has to do with the change in their lives. Remember, Jacob means supplanter. And he supplanted or gained the advantage over Esau at their birth and then later, chapter 27. Israel means one who has power with God. And that would be a representative of not only Jacob as a person, but as Israel, a nation as a whole.
Kind of like a blessing.
Right, in the name. Yeah, that would be involved there. Mm-hmm. Okay.
Yeah, you made a good point there. To me, Jacob means a trickster.
Mm-hmm.
He tricked Esau out of his birthright, so God didn't want his people to be called a trickster.
Well,
so
one could understand that.
I think that Israel, as you pointed out, meaning the churches of God, they had power with God.
Yeah. Now, was Israel a supplanter? No, not really, because God's the one that set them up. Did they push out other nations? Yes, but there's a difference. That's the reason why, of course, sometimes they are called Jacob. But it all has to do with Israel is by far the more common name. They're also called Ephraim sometimes as well. But
Christ did the same too when you look at Saul and Paul, or you look at... Peter, yeah.
Stone, mm-hmm. Right.
The names are changing. They're at changing points of their lives too.
Right. With Paul, the Apostle Paul, there seems to be less of a spiritual change that had to do with his difference between the Hebrew and Roman names. But he is certainly called Paul more often in the New Testament than Saul. Saul at the beginning, and there is some significance there about us. Obviously, some change there as well. But that's exactly right. With the Apostle Peter, stone having to do with Matthew 16, obviously, as well. Okay? Petros and Petra and so forth. Mentioned there.
Sons of John.
Right, sons of thunder. Why were they called that? Yeah, right. Okay? So, a little interesting note about Deborah there. And anyway, she came into the household of Jacob somewhere along the line, obviously, because she was here with them at this time. And so God is reiterating what he had told him in chapter 32 where he changed his name. And God said unto him, I am God Almighty. Be fruitful and multiply, a nation and a company of nations shall be of thee, and kings shall come out of thy loins. There certainly would be, would there not? Many kings coming concerning the land of Israel. And the land which I gave Abraham and Isaac, to thee will I give it, and to thy seed after thee will I give the land. That's interesting. Notice how God is saying that. I gave the land to Abraham and Isaac. Did Abraham and Isaac ever possess the land of Canaan? They didn't. But God gave it to them, Barbara. What does that mean?
It surely was theirs.
It was. Wasn't it? But just not an actual physical possession.
He gave it to them in promise.
True? Now, somebody turn to 2 Peter chapter 3. That's a pretty good example of what Peter's talking about in those verses there. 2 Peter chapter 3. Okay. You notice in verse 4 beginning, I did ask somebody to turn there, but I'm going to read it, so that's okay. Y'all probably don't mind too much, probably. In verse 4, and saying, where is the promise of his coming? For since the fathers fell asleep or died, all things continue as they were from the beginning of the creation. For this they willingly are ignorant of, that by the word of God the heavens were of old, and the earth standing out of water and in the water, whereby the world that then was being overflowed with water perished. That's the worldwide global Noahic flood. But the heavens and the earth, which are now, that is post-diluvian, in other words, after the flood, which are now, by the same word, are kept in store, reserved unto fire against the day of judgment and perdition of ungodly men. That's what's going to happen to the universe. So, notice verse 8, but beloved, be not ignorant of this one thing, that one day is with the Lord as 1,000 years, and 1,000 years is one day. Well, how many years approximately are we talking about from the time of the promise given to Abraham, Genesis 12, 1-3, and the taking of the land of Canaan properly, beginning in Joshua chapter 6 with the taking of Jericho? There were other battles and so forth before that, but that's properly Israel going into Canaan. How many years approximately are we talking about?
Well, it's
yeah.
500-600.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Some people date Abraham around 2000 B.C., some around 1900 or so, give or take a little bit there. And then the date of the conquest is right at 1400, maybe 1405 B.C. So yeah, we're looking at 500 years, give or take a little bit. Now, from the time of the promise in Genesis 12 to the time of the actual taking of the land of Canaan is about 500 years or so. Well, now, Peter's saying that with the Lord, one day is 1,000 years, and 1,000 years is one day. How does that correlate with what God just said about what he had given Abraham and Isaac, and also to Jacob here? Anybody have a thought there? How does those two verses work together? I'm talking about what's implied here from these explicit statements. No, it didn't, did it? And that's how he can say, I have given you the land, but they won't actually receive it for 500 years. That is, they won't actually take physical possession. That's what's involved here. Now, in verse 9 of the same opening, 2 Peter, notice that the Lord is not slack concerning his promise, as some men count slackness. Well, a lot of people would think, okay, just as these other people did here in verse 4, where is the promise of his coming? For since the beginning of the fathers fell asleep, all things continue as they were from the beginning of the creation. Nothing's changed. Well, why do you think that God kept he told Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, that I have given you this land, and I will give it unto your seed. So they would remember, even though you haven't gotten it yet, you're going to get it in reality. But I have, as surely as I have given it to you, they will receive it physically. And just as surely as they physically received it, I've given it to you, although you won't get it physically. Does that make sense? Let's take a break right there and you can think about it for a minute, because it's time for us to pause, and we'll just jump back on that in a minute.
So very much at the beginning of a big theme.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yep. Very much so.